This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Today we are diving into one of the most talked about events from this past weekend. It took place all across the country and in West Texas as well, the No Kings protest. One of those voices belongs to our guest today, Diana Luna. She is a candidate for the Texas House District 71. She's been gaining attention not only for her campaign, but also for her visible presence and advocacy at events like Saturday's protests. She joins us now to talk about what happened, why it matters, and how it ties into her vision for the district and the state. Diana, welcome, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Hi. Let's start with the basics. Can you tell us what the No Kings protest is and why there was interest in it?
The No Kings protest is it is a nationwide protest put on by the 50-51 movement, which stands for 50 protests in 50 states, but one movement. It's really about our constitutional rights and how this current administration doesn't seem to care about trampling them, and trying to reach that 3.5% threshold of the population of people that will turn out for change. And that is what it takes to resist these more nefarious types of policies. It takes community activism from the ground up.
Yeah. Diana, you were there on Saturday. I heard reports there might have been up to 500 people there. Can you tell me what was the scene like?
Yeah, our counters, we had a few different individual counters, and we counted 515 people. And it was mostly positive. I'm going to be honest, from hearing all the things on the news and hearing Greg Abbott saying he was going to deploy National Guard, I was nervous to really encourage people to bring their children, because you just never know what's going to happen, especially here in Abilene. At Pride, there was somebody who was arrested for making violent threats online. But I was so proud of everybody for being brave and being positive. And it was a really joyful event. I actually was not involved with the organization of the protest. I know the organizer, and she asked me if I would speak because I am running for office and I do support what they're doing. And so she asked me if I would speak, and I asked her if I could table there because I'm really trying to get out and meet constituents and any way that I can. This was the only protest in our area that was going to be hitting a lot of the counties that I am hoping to represent. So I was hoping to meet people from all over the big country.
Why was it important for you as a candidate to be there? I mean, obviously for the campaigning as well, but I mentioned that you were there, well, for reasons that were political.
Yeah. I am a brown person, and I am very concerned about the legislation that was recently upheld by the Supreme Court that said that I can be racially profiled. I know people who came into the country through legal status and were waiting on their asylum hearing, who are currently in detention, and they have legal status in this country. And overnight, their legal status was taken away. I think it's important for whenever people are being honestly persecuted for no other reason than the color of their skin, or because an agency has to meet quotas, that it is our responsibility to stand up for those people.
Diana, you've said the why. How could you make a change if you were elected to District 71? How could you implement those thoughts?
Honestly, implementing change alone is very hard. So which is why anytime I get the chance, I also like to highlight all of the other candidates in Texas and in the, not just for the state house, but also for federal offices that are running to flip the seat. And how I tell people how there's precinct chairs and how there are city positions that are needing to be filled. Because if we want our voices heard, we have to do what other people have been doing for a long time. And we have to get in places of power and in voices where our opinions can actually be taken into account.
All right. That was Diana Luna. Thank you for joining us today. She is a candidate for Texas House District 71, sharing her perspective on that No Kings protest in Abilene. Across the country, the No Kings demonstration spanned more than 2,700 events in all 50 states. Organizers say over 7 million people participated. Across the country, the No Kings demonstrations spanned more than 2,700 events in all 50 states. And organizers say over 7 million people participated. We also had a chance to hear from Melissa Weaver with Defend Democracy Abilene about the importance of the smaller events.
We're just a local grassroots organization. We do have a sister group in Lubbock that has started, Defend Democracy Lubbock, but it's just local grassroots activists. So we organize the protests locally. You know, just getting everything together. New Kings does a lot of the advertising and branding of that. But other than that, it's just local organizers. Well, it's, you know, mainly a lot of, you know, getting permits to be at, you know, protest at City Hall or a park or wherever. You know, you have to talk to city management and Abilene Police Department and things of that nature so that everyone is aware of what's going on. We hired Abilene police officers to be there to make sure everyone was safe and everything stayed peaceful and nothing, you know, nothing happened. Safety is always our first concern. We had more people show up to this event than we did the last one. That was a concern of mine. You know, it's just kind of a tense political climate right now. And so that, you know, we may have had more attendance had that not been. So I get the sentiment that, especially in a very red county and state, that our, you know, a vote to a Democrat doesn't matter because we're not going to win. But that's the problem. You know, showing up to these protests, especially in large numbers, shows people, like other people, that, you know, not everybody wants to protest. Not everybody is going to get out there and protest. You know, they say for every one protester, there's, you know, 3 to 5 more that would love to be there, but can't due to their job or they're scared or, you know, whatever the reason may be. But like, whenever people show up and you see this large crowd, and you're like, you know what? These people feel the same way I do. And that gives people courage to stand up and maybe be at the next event. And it makes people feel like they're not alone. You know, like we had over 500 people show up. That tells me something. It tells me that I'm not alone in the way I feel. It tells me that, you know, there were professional people. There were doctors. There were professors there. There were farmers there were, you know, all walks of life at this last event. And so that gives me hope. It also, for me, you know, one of the biggest things that we like to talk about is getting people to vote. And we always have someone available at the events to register people to vote. Because our vote does matter. Right now, we are trying to get people, we're definitely getting people on the ballot. There's a lot of uncontested seats in Taylor County, and our vote will matter whenever it comes to, you know, primaries. Mm-hmm. We just have to get people mobilized to actually get out and vote. Every single vote matters, and if we all, you know, the voter turnout in Taylor County was very low. So there's a very small percentage of the people here making the decisions. But, you know, I know that we do have the power if we utilize it, if we get the people to, you know, mobilize and vote, then we may have a fighting chance.
Yeah.
But the problem is that we also like, oh, well, this is just too conservative of an area. It's not going to matter. You know, voting is pointless, but it honestly isn't, because I believe it was like one of the last elections that we had, there was like 6,000 people that voted and that was it. 7,000 people to vote out of almost 200,000 people, 180,000 people. Like, we could actually do something.
Right.
And the thing about it is that we're just normal, everyday people. You know, everybody in our organization lives in the community. We are invested in the community. No one is bust in. I wish that someone would send me a mysterious check, you know, because, you know, we spend a lot, you know, we spend our own money to, you know, pay for permits and for the police officers to be stationed there. That's all just us chipping in together to be able to cover the cost of these events. But it's so important. We have to do it. But there's no, you know, there's no boogeyman billionaire that's funding us. We're just normal, everyday people that are concerned about our community and our nation right now.
No!
Yay!
No!
Yay!
No!
Yay!
No!
We'll continue following the race for District 71, and we'll bring you stories that shape our town and our state. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Today is the third day of early voting in Texas. There are a few candidates for special elections, but the vast majority of the state's voters are only deciding whether or not to add new amendments to the state's constitution or other local questions. KCU's Heather Claiborne checked in with Taylor County's election administrator, Frieda Reagan.
Frieda, how many registered voters are there in the county right now? And can you tell us what the turnout trend is in Taylor County for elections like this one with no local or statewide candidates, let alone a presidential candidate?
Well, currently in Taylor County, we have some 88,000 plus registered voters. Typically in constitutional amendment elections, just statistically, turnout is fairly low. In 23, which was the last constitutional amendment election, we had three different schools joining us then also. Likewise, with this election, we have basically four schools in Taylor County that are holding either tax ratification elections, a bond election, or, you know, they're electing school board members. So when those entities join in a constitutional amendment, sometimes that will spark a lot more interest. Yesterday, we voted 341 people in person, and I think in 23, which was a pretty comparable election with this one, 400 and something people voted. So. And in 2021, in November of 21, we had a grand total of 5,385 people. So 5,385 people voted. That's early and election day, which was like a 6.5% turnout. And then in 23, let me see what the turnout was there. So in 23, we had 14 constitutional amendments, and we had 14,700 voters. But we also, in 23, had Merkel ISD held a bond election. Gymnet School District held an election. The city of Abilene held an election. And so it was – and Wiley. Wiley ISD had a bond election. So a lot of other races that possibly generated, you know, some interest and turnout was affected by that.
And so, in an election year where we have major candidates or a presidential candidate, we're going to have tens of thousands of people going to the polls.
Oh, yeah. So next year, it'll be a gubernatorial year. And so, yes, by the time November gets here, we'll have a lot more voters turn out. The last gubernatorial was in 22. We voted 39,605 people.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
And so over the last legislative session, the state lawmakers considered about 288 constitutional amendments, and then we ended up, as you said, with 17 on this ballot. Is this kind of a quick vote for most people, or do you see them taking a little more time to consider the questions when it's this type of a ballot versus with candidates?
Yes, yes. And, you know, I tend to think that these type of elections are typically going to be your voters that vote in every election. And unless it's something that really sparks their interest, or, you know, there's a lot of controversy or contention with a particular constitutional amendment, we typically don't see a huge turnout. And we've had people say, well, the wording is so confusing. We have a lot of calls from voters that want to know, where can I find information? People will tend to not vote because they don't understand the wording. They don't understand what it's saying. And we as election officials cannot try to interpret that or help them understand what it's meaning, because then we would be influencing their vote. So it is important that on these type of elections that voters do their homework, do their due diligence to understand and educate themselves on what it is that they're voting on.
We have sent some of our listeners to ballotpedia.org, which is a website that includes the information and description of the ballot measures, as well as who is for and against them, and a brief description of why people support or oppose them. So that gives a pretty good background for each of these. Are there any new rules around voting this year, or any changes that folks maybe should be aware of before they head to the polls?
Yes, a couple of items that we do want to make sure voters are aware of, and one of them being changes in the cell phone usage. The law before was you could not use your cell phone within 100 foot of the voting stations, which the voting station is basically the voting booth. So now the cell phone cannot be used within a room in which voting is taking place. In addition, they cannot use their phones outside that room to record sound or images. So that is a change. We do have new signage up that at each polling place that makes that, you know, clear to the voter. So we just ask that voters, you know, everybody's on their phones. We all are. If you're standing in line somewhere waiting to get your food, waiting to go into an event, whatever that might be, we all tend to, you know, we pull out our phones and we get on our phones. But we're just asking voters that for the short time that they might be there to vote, just put it away and work with us. The other thing that changed is there are some changes to curbside voting. As you know, and across the state, curbside voting is available at all polling places. And curbside voting is available to, the way the law states, curbside voting is available to those voters who are physically unable to enter the polling place without the likelihood of without the need for personal assistance or the likelihood of injuring their health. So if a voter is eligible and meets those requirements, they can vote a curbside ballot, meaning we will bring the ballot out to their vehicle and they can vote from the comfort of their vehicle. However, in order to do that, the law has changed, and now that curbside voter will be required to sign a statement attesting to that fact that they are physically unable to enter that polling place.
Okay, good to know.
If the voter refuses to sign that statement, they cannot vote curbside. They would have to go in and vote inside the polling place.
Okay. And I know there's a deadline this week for people wanting to vote by mail, correct?
Yes. The 24th is the last day that we can receive that request in our office.
Frieda Reagan, thank you for your time.
You're so very welcome. Thank you. Anytime.
Early voting is underway Monday through Friday until October 31st. Polling locations are set at the Taylor County Plaza, Abilene City Hall, the Mall of Abilene, and the United Supermarkets on South 14th Street. Merkle ISD and Gymned CISD also have polling locations set up in their administration buildings. You can find all this information, including times of operation, on KACU's social media or, of course, on the Taylor County website. Election Day is November 4th. This is the West Texas Dispatch. This year's Texas Business Hall of Fame is recognizing some of the state's most promising entrepreneurs, including one Abilene High School student whose small idea turned into a growing business. KACU's Ioneason Ohizio has more.
At the end of the month, Abilene High senior Hudson Peitzik will be inducted into the Texas Business Hall of Fame as the Outstanding High School Entrepreneur of the Year. He'll be recognized for his business, Hudson's pressure washing and window cleaning, in front of some of the biggest business professionals in the state. While Hudson's pressure washing and window cleaning has grown to produce nearly $35,000 in profit annually, Peitzik remembers when all he had was an idea and a $30 squeegee.
I saw a guy selling window cleaning, and I thought I could do the same. So I bought a squeegee and just went out.
With his squeegee in hand, Peitzik resigned from his job at Chipotle and made some business cards, and set out to start his business. He landed his first window cleaning jobs with his friend and coworker, Duke Decker. He says he and Duke have taken on managerial roles.
I do work with Duke on bigger jobs. He manages other people, as do I. He also goes door-to-door with me on occasion to get more jobs.
While managing classwork and extracurriculars during the first year, Peitzik maintained client relations and secured $10,000 in equipment to elevate the business. Peitzik's father, Seth Peitzik, owns a consulting business, and Peitzik says he's learned a lot from his father's customer service expertise.
He's really good at knowing what people want to hear as far as how to create the best experience for customers, so that's been great, as well as advice on how to manage employees if they do like a job wrong or something.
After graduation, Peitzik plans to move to a bigger city in Texas and intends to continue building the business there, using profits to run ads and lay the groundwork for eventual expansion into cities like Dallas, San Antonio, Nashville, and Indianapolis.
We'll kind of stay local until in a few years after next Christmas light season is when we'll start to expand much bigger.
Peitzik has already gotten a taste of expansion, working alongside Billy Duggar, a local businesswoman who co-owns her cleaning service. The two have worked out a deal. Billy gets contracted to clean the inside of new buildings and calls in Peitzik for the outside.
We got a new Chase Bank on the south side, a new Chewy's. We recently got a new Chick-fil-A. So I've cleaned the outsides of all those buildings. There's a new neighborhood on Maple Street being built, and I've cleaned those houses, the windows.
Peitzik will officially be awarded the Ishan Thakur Outstanding High School Entrepreneur Award at the annual Future Texas Business Legend Awards Luncheon in Houston on October 29th. While Peitzik looks forward to the future of his company, he also knows now what he would do differently.
If I would talk to myself, I would probably say wait to diversify. I think I got into pressure washing too soon.
He also knows what he needs to keep doing.
I've learned a whole lot, which is more important to me than the money I'm making now, which is with the workers, especially, just making sure they're happy is very, very important. And then making sure you have a top quality service, super important to me.
Abilenians and people in surrounding areas can find contact information on Instagram at Hudson's_windows. Or you can wait for the high school senior to knock on your door with a stack of deep blue business cards. I'm Mihina Sinohizwa with KACU.
Marfa Public Radio has a new podcast out that's been in the works for more than a year. A whole other country explores the creation and bloody dissolution of the short-lived Republic of Texas secessionist movement. It flourished in the off-grid community here in West Texas back in the 1990s. In 1997, Rick McLaren and his group declared war on the U.S. government, and they pulled their neighbors and nation into the drama of a real-life Wild West standoff. For more on this uniquely West Texas tale, we caught up with senior producer Joe Kurland, who reported and produced the show for them.
This saga of the Republic of Texas and the standoff in the Davis Mountains Resort is sort of well known to people who have lived here in West Texas for a long time. But as the years have gone by, the story's kind of faded into history. There hasn't really been any kind of deep dive documentary style project made about this whole ordeal. So what made you want to do that with this podcast?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that audio presents a totally different opportunity than, say, a book or an article. This was highly covered in the 90s, and there have been a couple of books written about it. But a podcast presents the opportunity to hear the voices of the people who were there, the voices of people talking about this very special neighborhood, the Davis Mountains Resort, where this movement took place. And I felt like this was an amazing opportunity to capture not only the story, but the people who were there and are still there. And also right now, you know, this story is about 30 years old, but the themes that it brings up, the questions it raises, themes of independence, themes of mythologies, this idea of people coming out to far West Texas to live out a kind of fantasy life. Those themes are really relevant and things that I'm really interested in and find that we as Marfa Public Radio have a really unique opportunity to cover.
Who was Rick McLaren? I mean, how did he find his way to this very secluded West Texas community in the first place?
Rick McLaren was a guy from Ohio who was really enamored of Texas. He said that he did a book report on the Alamo and Davy Crockett in either the third or fourth grade. And that really turned him on to Texas and sort of the mythologies of this place and the stories of this place. And as he got older, he started reading more about Texas, moved to Texas with his first wife. And then as he read more regional magazines like Texas Highways and Texas Monthly, he learned about this burgeoning wine industry in Fort Davis. So he moved out here to make his fortune as a winemaker. And then when the winemaking plan didn't pan out, he basically went really deep on the history of his neighborhood. He wasn't making his home payments and he wanted to get out of that. And he found out a lot of stuff about the development of the Davis Mountains Resort, which he used to his advantage to put a bunch of false liens on his neighbors and use adverse possession law to try to get their land. And that kind of tied the DMR up in legal battles. And then he started the Republic of Texas.
Was there anything in your reporting of this tale and talking to all the people impacted by it, again, some of whom still live out here, that just really surprised you, that you hadn't heard before about this story?
Yeah, I was surprised he was a winemaker. But I was also really surprised to learn how rooted in the Davis Mountains this movement was.
This is admittedly kind of a corny question, but what do you hope that people will take away from listening to this podcast?
I think that what you'll get out of it is, sure, the story of the Republic of Texas and a deep dive on Texas history and the history of that movement, but also the insights of the people who live in the Davis Mountains Resort, who have moved out to this off-the-grid neighborhood that is kind of mysterious and private in certain ways to live a very unique life. And my favorite part of this reporting and what I hope this project communicates is why people chose to live this life. And alongside the story of the Republic of Texas is the story of the Davis Mountains Resort and the people who live there.
A Whole Other Country is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for West Texas Roots. I'm Alexis Jones. This week, we'll hear about how the Bob White Brigade, otherwise known as Quail Camp, helped young Riley Scott learn how to navigate native plants of West Texas, how to conserve wildlife, and encouraged a lifelong curiosity in science.
Quail Camp is the nickname that I've termed for this. the true name of this camp is called the Bob White Brigade. So you have different brigade camps. Like you could go to deer camp, technically, or fish camp, a mix of both type camp. And this one was quail camp. So Bob White is a breed of quail that we find typically out here in West Texas. So when my family moved from Peaster to Albany, we couldn't find any housing that we could afford. But my grandma was living in Albany, and so she let us live there, at least for the start of our first year there. So my freshman year, we were living in my grandma's house, so we helped clean it out before we could move in. And so her neighbor was a guy named Alan Herman. Basically, Alan came over while we were cleaning out and said, "Hey, I think your girls should sign up for this." He was a kind of a proponent for these camps. And my parents said yes without really consulting us and sent us off for a week to quail camp, my sister and I, while they did who knows what, enjoyed some vacation for a week. So it was intense. We got there first day, like literally middle of nowhere, Coleman, Texas. It's 90 degrees outside. We have no idea what we're walking into, and we dissect a quail underneath an awning outside for the first day, which, like, I'm a science girly, so that part was kind of fun. But it was all centered around quail conservation. Like, at that point, it was what, 2014? Yeah, it was 2014, and I guess the quail around here in West Texas, the population was super low, so quail conservation was a very important topic, and it was ran boot camp style. We slept in like this old little cabin area with a couple other girls, and you were assigned to a covey. And a covey of quail was like six or more quail. And so we were just assigned to different groups called coveys. And so my covey was called the California covey for the California quail. And so you had different types of quail names that each group took on. And we would have to wake up. I feel like it was 5:30 a.m., if not 6 a.m., and we would have to go outside on this grassy lawn and march. But we had to practice marching in these chants, and then at the very end of quail camp, we had to perform our marches and chants for our parents. And horrible. But, like, I don't know. If you knew what a Bob White Brigade was, you would love quail camp. But it was horrifying for my sister and I. And then throughout the day, it was a series of classes, if you will, and lectures on quail conservation. So we were all sitting in this one hall. So it was me and my sister, and then we made friends with a couple girls that were actually from Fort Worth. Don't know why they were at quail camp, but they were. I think they were also forced by their parents. But it lecture-wise, he would have different speakers come up talking about, like, you know, what type of plants do quails like to live in for camouflage, and what plants do they eat, and all the things. And so we had such long lectures sometimes that they had to bring out ice cubes, like bowls of ice cubes, so that we could grab it and put it on the back of our necks to stay awake while they were talking about quail conservation. So we were all super tired, ice cubes on the back. And of course, we weren't just in a lecture hall, if you will, all day. Another little activity, we had a softball. So they gave us a softball, and roughly a quail is the size of a softball, like height-wise. And so we could figure out if there was good quail coverage, like camouflage in a certain area, if we threw a softball and you couldn't see it, if like the ragweed was tall enough. And we had to learn plant ID, what they ate, what they would want to hide in. There was another thing where, like, another day we had a taxidermy lesson. So we had like actual quail that were already gutted out. And so we were sitting in this different room, and like an actual taxidermist was leading us through taxidermy 101. And so we had the borax and we had the fake eyeballs. And so we got to stuff our quail, taxidermy our quail, and then mount it to like a wooden Texas mount. And then it had a little plate that said Bob White Brigade 2014. And I honestly still have it to this day. It was a horrible taxidermy job. The quail looks like it's been through it, but 10 years later, it is up in my classroom.
We recorded Riley's story in Abilene.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. This Halloween season, the historic Paramount Theater is conjuring up more than just spooky vibes. They're mixing a little bit of movie magic with a dash of hands-on craft. In a special screening of Practical Magic, guests are invited to bring their knitting, embroidery, or whatever craft speaks to their inner witch. It's part of a larger trend we're seeing in the rise of so-called grandma hobbies among the younger generations. KACU's Alexis Jones sat down with Katie Hahn to find out more on how the Paramount is turning movie night into a cozy, creative celebration of fall, and why picking up a pair of knitting needles might just be the perfect spell for the season.
Okay, so can you tell me a little bit about what this event is and what inspired it?
Yeah, so this is craft cinema is what we're calling it. It is not a new idea, but it's new for us. We're very excited about it. We're going to be showing the film Practical Magic from 1998. Mm-hmm. And in that time, we're going to allow people to bring their own crafts from home. If they want to quilt, if they want to embroider or knit or draw or anything like that, we'll have the lights half up in the theater to enable a little more visibility. And so it'll be a different from a traditional movie going experience at the Paramount, but we're excited about it because we don't do anything like this. And right. So it's a little bit of an experiment, but people seem to be really excited about it. So
yeah.
We're also going to have, we have three sponsors for this event. We have Abilene Yarn Company, Scenic Route, and 7-in-1 Books. And all three of them are going to be set up in our lobby, both in the time before the show starts, so from 6:30 to 7:30, and then also during our short intermission in the middle of the movie to sell craft type things.
Got it.
So we're very excited about that. It'll be, I'm thinking of it as a fun community event.
So it's definitely a community collaboration. I know I've been talking with my friends in the past few months about the rise of grandma hobbies. You know, did that kind of influence you in wanting to do this event?
Oh, 100%. I am a coastal grandma at heart. Mm-hmm. So that's very much that. Part of what inspired it is, you know, I had seen videos of these kinds of events on TikTok and on other social media platforms. And the summer, George and I were at a historic theater conference in Pittsburgh, and lots of our other colleagues who work at other theaters were talking about implementing this kind of event at their theaters. It worked really well for them, and a lot of them said, hey, this was so great the first time that we're going to keep doing it every year. And so I thought, what a fun way to engage our audience in a different way. And I want to do more of these kind of special event
right.
movies. We have a great film series, but I love these things that are kind of standalone, kind of what you might see at an Alamo Draft House or
yeah.
something like that, where maybe you do a quote along here and there. We did that Grease sing along back in January. That was really, really fun. So something that kind of elevates the movie experience and makes it an event rather than I'm going to just sit and watch a movie.
Yeah.
And so it was fun because George okayed that idea. And then when I came back and I presented that to Amelia Richardson, who's our assistant director of operations, Amelia was like, oh, I've been wanting to do that too. And I've been seeing stuff online about it. And so we all had the same idea and just kind of came together at the same time. And so now it's been a fun little project to work on together. We're very excited about it.
And I know for me, so for people that have never been to an event like this, because like mm-hmm. you said, we've never had one in town. What can they expect? Like if they get to the door, what should they bring beforehand? Walk them through the day.
Yeah, this is great. So we will open our doors at 6:30. The event starts at 7:30. Mm-hmm. When you get to the event, get there early, get there earlier in that window because we're going to have vendor tables from our sponsors set up.
Yeah.
So we'll have two on the floor, on the ground level of the lobby. We'll have one up on the mezzanine. And so people can kind of shop. Our bar will be open. Our concessions will be open. And so people can get a drink, a snack, kind of walk around, get in the feel. We'll have, you know, some nice, probably Stevie Nicks type music playing in the theater itself to kind of get us in the headspace for the movie. And then we will start the movie at 7:30. And in that time, like I said, this will be a little bit different from a regular movie experience because we will have the lights half up. So a lot of people have asked, do I have to come craft? Can I just come watch the movie? Absolutely. Just know that it won't be a pitch black experience like we normally would do.
Right.
But we will, you know, we'll have the stars and the clouds turned on and all of those things. Something to note is our general policy on what you can bring for crafts is if it can be vacuumed up, amazing. So thread, yarn, fabric, things like that. If you want to bring your iPad and draw, you can do that. If you want to, if you need to bring a headlamp, you can do that too. That's more than welcome. Just right. kind of be mindful of your neighbor.
Right.
You can bring scissors. We prefer if they're the smaller kind with a little cap on them, like embroidery scissors,
okay.
Things like that. If it's paint, if it's glitter, if it's clay, if it's permanent markers, anything along, if it's glue, mm-hmm. anything along those lines, please leave it at home, because as you know, we have a beautiful historic theater and we are trying to keep it nice. So if you do have those things and we see them out, we may ask you to put them away so that we can keep everything nice in there.
Yeah,
and
like the grandma hobbies and not the grandkid hobbies.
Correct. Yes. So people have asked about like friendship bracelets and things like that. Absolutely. 100%. Anything that can be vacuumed up, we're good. So yeah, it'll be different, but it's going to be fun. And I'm hoping that maybe it's not so quiet as a normal movie, as that people are kind of chatting with each other and, oh man, oh yes, I remember this. This is my favorite part. Like things like that, because they're going to be able to see everybody and while they're crafting and things like that.
I guess this is a good situation for people who maybe don't have a craft or a grandma hobby. They can come and they can see the vendors and like
yes.
one before the movie.
Exactly.
Right?
And I know that they are all going to be selling things that somebody could pick up and do. And I think 7-in-1 may be also selling some books.
And tickets are still available?
The tickets are still available. They are $10, so it's a little higher than our regular movie cost, but if you come to buy them in person or buy them at the door on the night of the show, you don't have to pay that dollar ticketing fee on that. So it's just $10 flat. So you can buy them online, over the phone with us, or in person at the Paramount.
Perfect. Katie, thanks for talking to me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And before we go, we have a favor to ask. As we start to prepare for the holidays, we thought we'd see if there's a favorite recipe you would be willing to share with us. Tell us about Grandma's best pecan pie, Aunt Judy's special beans, or your dad's smoked turkey. But shoot us a message if you've got a holiday recipe you think West Texas should try. Email us info@kacu.org and put Dispatch Recipes in the subject line. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We had help this week from our producer, Alexis Jones, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.